Tonight we're in Job 38, home stretch this week and next week, and if the Lord doesn't surprise us, we will wrap up our study through Job. The following week is the 4th of July. We will not have a Wednesday evening service on July 4th, and when we return after that brief break, Pastor Rob will be doing a 4 or 5 week study through the book of Ruth. And I'm going to be lateraling over to Thursday night during some of that time teaching our End Times for Beginners class. Long time getting to Job 38. It's been a little bit of a while. Two chapters of exposition is how the book starts, the conversation between God and Satan. 30 chapters of back and forth between Job and his friends. 6 chapters of Elihu, annoying all of us. Beginning tonight, we hear from God. We previewed that last week. We got just one verse into chapter 38 where we noticed God speak from a whirlwind. Tonight we're going to hear some of what he has to say. And it's going to be interesting because having heard what Job and his friends and Elihu all said, some true things, some not true things, a lot of irrelevant things, what God is going to say doesn't directly respond to any of those things, but at the same time manages to put all of it in perspective. I thought about trying to take 4 chapters tonight. I don't think we're going to quite get there, but over the next couple weeks, we're going to cover the remaining 5 chapters. It seems like a lot, and it is a lot, but it's helpful to hear the scope of what God says to Job in big chunks, because the whole really is more than the sum of the parts in this case. As you listen tonight, and next week as well, but tonight, since that's when we're here, pay attention to what God says, but also look into the white spaces. Notice what it is that God doesn't say. And when we get to the end of chapter 39, the beginning of chapter 40, we'll talk a little bit about that. The question that people attached to the book of Job is, why do the innocent suffer? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why is this burden come upon me? Why has this trial visited me? What did I do? Spoiler alert, God isn't going to answer that question. Not tonight, not next week, not ever in the book of Job. God never reveals to Job the conversation he has with Satan in the first 2 chapters of the book. Job, at least as far as we know, never comes to understand why the things, many things, horrible things that God allowed in his life took place. Job is never going to get an answer to the question, why? But he's going to leave content. He's going to still end up satisfied. What does God say? What does he not say? Let's hear for ourselves. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, verse 1. We saw God approaching last week, and we noticed how, as the storm approached and God in the storm, Elihu's tone changed. The presence of the Lord changes things. God arrives in the wind, and God speaks, saying, verse 2, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? I like the Living Bible rendering of this. The Living Bible is not a translation. It's not even a good transliteration. It's more of a commentary. But every once in a while, the way it renders something is pretty good. Verse 2, the Living Bible says, why are you using your ignorance to deny my providence? I like that. That's eloquent. That's God saying, why are you speaking from a place of ignorance? And why are you not only speaking from a place of ignorance, but why are you trying to tear me down in the process? An interesting question to ask, I don't know the answer, is God addressing Elihu or Job when he says this? Elihu is the last person to speak. It's plausible that God is saying, Elihu, you block, you stone, you worse than senseless thing. Just stop, please. And brushes Elihu away in order to address Job. It's also possible that God ignores Elihu altogether and is immediately addressing Job, because both Job and Elihu have been speaking, at least to some extent, from ignorance. God continues, verse 3, now prepare yourself like a man. Be careful from where we go from here. Because if you hear what I hear in this verse, if I'm not paying attention, you hear an older father figure scolding you. You hear an older father figure shaking a finger at Job and saying, be a man. Big boys don't cry. Suck it up. Tape it together. Play with pain. That's not God's tone. It's not God's tone here, and it's not God's tone in any of the verses that follow. And if we're confused about that, we're going to be confused about everything that happens tonight. Prepare yourself like a man. What's Job's posture at this point? He's probably curled up in the fetal position. He's preparing to die. He's convinced his death is imminent. And he's wailing. And nothing he's heard from people who call themselves his friends, nothing he's heard from Elihu, the self-appointed expert, have changed his perception even a little bit. What is God saying? He's not saying to Job, suck it up. He's not saying to Job, face death straight in the eye. He's saying, Job, let's talk. He's saying, Job, let's have a conversation. Let's talk as men. You're made in my image. You were created for a relationship. Let's have that relationship. Let's have a conversation. I'll question you. You answer me. Let's do it like that. Job has begged for that opportunity. He's begged for the opportunity to have a conversation with God, and God in his mercy is giving Job that opportunity, the dialogue that he's been praying for. But when God says, I'll question you and you shall answer me, he means it. He's going to lay 77 questions, one after the other, on our friend Job. It's going to sound a little bit like an interrogation. Try not to hear it that way. Try to hear it through the ears of someone hearing from a father who loves him. God's got 77 questions. His intent is to love Job. He's going to start off with a chapter's worth of questions about creation. If you're outlining these chapters, chapter 38, God says to Job, let's have a conversation. Let's have a discussion. Let's talk about creation for a moment. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Verse 4. Let's begin at the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Job, were you there? It's a rhetorical question, but God's laying the foundation for something that he wants Job to understand. Job, when I breathed the universe into existence, were you standing behind me? Did I not see you? Or did you have a friend there? Did you get the notes from someone who was in class that day? Has someone else brought you up to speed? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements, the foundations of the earth? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? 77 questions, we're only 5 in. Can already tell the conversation isn't going to be exactly what Job was expecting. It's not what Job was hoping for, I'm sure. He was hoping for answers. Instead, he's getting more questions. He has to be wondering at this juncture, what's God's point? Where is he going with this? Worth pausing to understand, God isn't trying to embarrass Job. The kindness of the Lord leads us to repentance. Even if we understand, God is trying to turn Job around. He's trying to help Job adjust his attitude. He's trying to remedy Job's faulty thinking. He's not trying to make him feel small in the process. He's trying to expand Job's perspective. Job, you've been crying out that you don't understand. I want to show you something. I want to help you realize there's a lot of things, a lot of things that you don't understand. There are more things in this universe that you don't understand than you do understand. And if everything else made sense, if you had a handle on the workings of the universe and there was just this one piece that was missing, if everything else was well understood and the only piece that was escaping your comprehension was what's been happening to you these last days, well, that would be a different conversation. But as it stands, Job, I want to help you realize most of the world that you live in does not make sense to you. And before you tell me I'm doing a bad job running the universe, or at least your corner of it, Job, I want you to ask yourself, are you in a position to evaluate how God, Creator, is running the rest of the universe? You've been in the position, I'm sure, when someone who didn't understand what you did for a living tried to tell you how to do it better. Usually that person was your boss, or a customer, or a coworker. We've all had someone parents of small children, parents when you had small children. Did you have the conversation with the single person who wanted to tell you how to parent small children? You've been there, right? I've been a basketball coach and had people who didn't understand that the round ball goes in the round hole try to tell me how to coach better. We've all had those experiences. That's a little bit what God is trying to open Job's mind up. Job, that's who you are right now. You're the single person telling me how to parent. You're the creation telling me how to create. Who laid the cornerstone of the universe when the morning stars sang together, verse 7, and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Morning stars, sons of God, that's idiomatic for angels. Hey, Job, when I laid the foundation of the universe, the angels were there. I didn't see you. The angels were there. They blessed my name. They celebrated. They rejoiced. Here's what they didn't do. They didn't tell me how to do it better. The angels didn't consult on the blueprints of the universe. They just were excited that they got ringside seats to the show. Verse 8, who shut the sea? Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? Now God moves on to the second day of creation. Hey, Job, when the seas were birthed like a baby, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, were you around for that? The image here, if it seems a little bit strange, remember that the water of the earth initially was contained in the atmosphere. We believe, based on what we read in Genesis, that great, great stores of water were essentially a canopy or a swaddling band around the globe until the flood, when God released it. Job, were you there when I stored up all of that water in the canopy of the atmosphere? Were you there when I fixed my limit for the waters and set bars and doors? When I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. Next, God's going to turn his focus to the sun. Verse 12, have you commanded the morning since your days began? Job, have you made the sun rise even once? I do it every day, but have you done it one time? And cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? Job, when we talk about light and darkness, do you realize when we talk about light and darkness, we're talking about more than light and darkness? Do you realize there's also a conversation about good and evil happening at the same time? It takes on form like clay under a seal and stands out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Verse 16, have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Is he talking about the ocean again? I thought we left the ocean. We did. He's going back just to make a point. This is going to be an argument from lesser to greater. Job, do you know how deep the ocean is? No. Okay. Then how can you possibly understand how deep hell is? That's the question God is asking. Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Job has talked from ignorance. He's talked about wanting to die. He suggested in his pain that it might have been better had he not been born. God is saying, how much of life and death do you really comprehend? You're tossing around these concepts like you have an intimate understanding of them. Job, I'm not sure that you do. I'm not sure that you even understand this universe in which you have your life, let alone what happens outside of your life, after your life. Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? I mean, do you even understand this plane of existence? Tell me if you know all this, verse 18. Do you know how far is east from west, in other words? Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you might take it to its territory, that you might know the paths to its home? Where does light come from, Job? And where does darkness go when we turn the lights on? Do you know it? Because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? And again, it's easy to hear this as badgering. It's even easy to hear this as mocking, as taunting. That doesn't fit. That doesn't fit with who God is. It doesn't fit with what we know of Job and how God views Job in the very beginning of the book. God was proud of Job. He held Job up. He put him on display. He said, Satan, have you considered how awesome Job is? It wouldn't make sense at this point for God to turn around and shame and ridicule him. What's God doing? He's teaching. Is he joshing with him a little bit? Yeah. Is he teasing with him a little bit? You bet. Is he indulging in some sarcasm? Certainly. Is he trying to crush him verbally? No way. He is trying to get his point across. Verse 22, have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I've reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? Commentators disagree on these verses. Is God just pointing out that atmospheric phenomena like snow and hail are beyond Job's understanding? Maybe. Is he pointing out that the billions of snowflakes that fall every year, no two are alike? That God designs each one uniquely, perhaps? Is he actually making a comment about war? Snow reserved for the time of trouble? Yeah, ask Napoleon about snow. Students of history, it was because of snow that Napoleon was defeated. Hail reserved for the time of trouble. We know in the tribulation, one of the judgments that God brings against the earth, 100-pound hailstones. I remember it was about 8 years ago, we had 12-pound hailstones, 8-pound hailstones falling in Wichita, punching holes in roofs. Whatever God means, he says, Job, there's stuff that happens in the atmosphere you haven't figured out yet. By which way is light diffused or the east wind scattered over the earth? We're going to come back to that. Verse 25, he talks about rain. Elihu was talking about the water cycle when we were together last week. God's going to say, hey, on that subject, who has divided a channel for the overflowing water or a path for the thunderbolt to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? And the frost of heaven, who gives it birth? The waters hardened like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. Job, you observe this. You see seasons. Snow comes, snow goes. Ice freezes, ice melts. Can you explain any of it? Let's talk about what goes beyond the heavens. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? He's moving on to stars. He's asking, Job, can you affect the shape of constellations? Can you say, you know what? I don't want a Big Dipper so much as maybe we just move some things around and make it an umbrella or a spear. Can you bring out the Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the Great Bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Do you know the rules that stars follow in their orbits? Can you set their dominion over the earth? The reality, Job, you can't affect things lower than the horizon. So we both know you can't affect the sky. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the mind, or who has given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together? And you can read verses 34 to 38 as literal. You can squint harder and wonder if God is running a metaphor there. But the interesting thing about all of these illustrations that God gives, all of these examples of things that Job doesn't know, isn't it interesting? He's using illustrations that are just as relevant for you and I today. Job, were you there when I laid the foundation of the earth? Were you there when I breathed the universe into existence? We know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times more about the size and shape of the universe than Job did. We talk about the gravitational forces that hold it together. We speculate about things like dark matter. We know so much more than Job, which is to say we know barely anything. And we can't even agree on the things that we do know. The size, the shape, the age of the universe. I think all we know 4,000 years later is we know we don't know. Not for sure. 4,000 years later, we still don't know the depth of the ocean. The best measurement, the deepest measurement, is about 6.8 miles. But there's a vast, vast amount of the ocean that has yet to be explored. We don't understand light. Is light a particle? Is light a wave? It has qualities of both. Which is it? We can't make rain with any consistency. When I was a little kid, I remember hearing we're about 5 years away from being able to seed clouds and drought is going to be a thing of the past because we'll be able to make it rain in drought-stricken areas. I'm still waiting. Not only hasn't it happened, I can't remember the last time I heard anybody talk about it. It seemed like it was in the news all the time when I was a little kid. I think we've given up on that. We struggle to know if it's going to rain. Isn't it amazing that the Holy Spirit chose metaphors that would be relevant 4,000 years after God first spoke them? Continuing chapter 38, verse 39. This is the beginning of a new section. I think the man-made chapter break is not at the right place, at least to my eyes. Because there's a new section here. Having talked to Job about his ability or lack of ability to bring the universe into existence, to create creation, God's gonna ask a second set of questions. He's going to say, okay, I'm hearing that you can't create creation, Job. Can you maintain creation? If I create it, if I build it, can you at least keep things going? Can you nurture or care for the animals that I've created, Job? Can you hunt prey for the lions, verse 39, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? God's saying, Job, you don't know how to care for lions. And the reason I know is you don't want to get close enough to lions to find out. But you know, I take care of them. I not only take care of lions, I use lions to take care of ravens. And what makes this especially interesting, what do we know about ravens? Clean or unclean? They're an unclean animal. God has said they're carrion eaters. And that's what God says here. He says, I use the lions, the carcasses of the lions kill to provide food for the raven. God cares about unclean birds. How much more so does he care about Job? God's going to make that point, but it's already lurking here. Verse 1 of chapter 39, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Have you studied their gestation period, Job? Do you know what time of year they usually bear young? Can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? Job had herds. We read that in the first couple chapters. And he probably helped some of his domesticated livestock, some of his sheep, his cattle, give birth. He was probably out there with the come-along, helping to pull calves. Job, have you ever done that for a wild animal? Does anybody do that for a wild animal? Job, I do that for wild animals. I take care of them. And here's the thing about wild goats. Verse 3, they bow down. They bring forth their young. They deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain. They depart and do not return to them. The wild mountain goat stands within minutes of being born. Within minutes of being born, it's up on its feet, and it leaves the mother very, very quickly. God is saying, how does it do that, Job? Do you help it? Does anyone help it? Who tells it when it's time to go? Who tells it where to go? Who protects it as it goes? That's me. Job, you don't understand creation. You don't really understand animals. You had herds, but you don't have the power over animals that you imagine that you do. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I've made in the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling? Job, you might be able to tame horses and cattle. You might even be brave enough to tame a lion. Some people do. You can't tame a wild donkey. No one can. Because God didn't create it to be tame. God created it for the wilderness. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. And it's not like the wild donkey is the only one. Verse 9, let's talk about the wild ox. Wild ox here is the aurochs. It's an ox the size of a small elephant. They became extinct around 1627 or so. There have been articles recently, if you geek out on some of this stuff, scientists have DNA. They have you know, DNA harvested from skeletons and so forth, and they're talking about trying to bring this species back and reintroduce it, like they're talking about doing with woolly mammoths and other extinct animals. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes, or will he plow the valleys behind you? Picture a pair of oxen the size of rhinos, because that's literally what we're talking about. God is saying, you want a couple of those out in your field? If you had them, what would you do with them? Will you trust him because his strength is great, or will you leave your labor to him? That's sort of, you know, where does an 800-pound gorilla sleep? Anywhere he wants, yeah. Where does an oxen the size of a hippopotamus plow? Wherever he decides to. Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Probably not. So here's another example of nature being beyond your control. God keeps going, verse 13, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? Here's where God indulges in a little bit of humor. Why does a flightless bird have wings, Job? Why can't a bird that has perfectly good wings fly? And it turns out that's not even the strangest thing about the ostrich, for she leaves her eggs in the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot might crush them or that a wild beast might break them. The thing about ostriches, they lay eggs and then they forget about them. And people argue about this, do they forget about them or do they just not care? Either way, she treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Ostriches don't have maternal instincts. Her labor is in vain without concern. Hey, there's an egg! What are you doing over here? They're bird-brained, literally. And God says, I made them that way. Verse 17, God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. Ostriches aren't smart, Job. Why? Why does that make sense? How is a species supposed to survive when the mothers don't have maternal instincts? Because somewhere in God's calculus, there's room for that. Just like there's room for a bird with big flapping wings that doesn't fly. But as foolish as the ostrich is, forgetting where she laid her eggs, when she lifts herself on high, verse 18, she scorns the horse and its rider. Ostriches can hit 35 miles an hour. Not flying, running. Ostriches can outrun horses for small distances. Ostriches get tired faster. But ostriches can outrun horses for over sprint distances. It's absurd. And just think if Job had lived in Australia, God would have said, okay, let's talk about the duck-billed platypus for a minute here. Job, can you explain God's sense of humor? creating a bird like the ostrich. Speaking of horses, have you given the horse strength? Verse 19. Here God is speaking of war horses. He's not speaking of riding horses or work horses. Job, speaking of war horses, have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. Why is a war horse that way? You'd think in the face of danger, any sensible animal would turn and run the other direction, and most do. Most animals have a built-in, well-developed sense of self-preservation. War horses run toward danger. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage. Nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Ha ha, we get to fight." He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. Can you train a horse to do that, Job? Can you train a horse to ignore its instincts of self-preservation? No. What's God's point? He's saying, Job, you don't seem to have a lot of skills. You don't seem to have a wide variety of animal husbandry talents at your disposal. Are you sure you're qualified to manage my creation? Just one more. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey, its eyes observe from afar, its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. Who teaches those birds to fly south, Job? And once they get south, who teaches them how to come back to the exact same place? Come to think of it, who teaches them how to fly? Who showed the eagle how to make its nest in a place that would take advantage of its unique vision? Who taught the eagle to nest and hunt the way that it does? And God could obviously keep going. But this is more than enough to make his point. And so he pauses here in chapter 40. He pauses to ask Job, Job, do you understand what I'm saying? Do you hear the point I'm making? Do you see where I'm coming from? The Lord answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him?" Job, it's your turn. I said what I have to say. Now you present your case. But before you do, before you say anything, Job, you have to ask yourself, are you qualified? I had a few questions for you there. How many answers did you have again? Still verse 2, "He who rebukes God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you?" Vile isn't a great translation for us. It was when it was first translated. The word vile has a different meaning than it did then. Vile doesn't mean here, Job isn't saying I'm disgusting, I'm loathsome, I'm sinful, I'm immoral. What he's saying is I'm small, I'm puny. Literally, he's saying I'm a lightweight. God, you're a heavyweight. I'm a flyweight next to you. I don't even want to get in the ring with you, Lord. I don't dare debate you. How can I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Interesting, Job previously told his friends, you guys need to hold your tongues. Now he's holding his. He's literally, I'm going to put my hand here because I'm afraid of what I might say if I don't. Once I've spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I'll proceed no further. God, the only thing I have to say is I have nothing to say. I can't say anything. What happened? What changed? Why is Job different? Situation didn't change. It's going to change. If you've read ahead, if you read Job before, you know Job's situation changes, but it hasn't yet, and Job doesn't know that it's going to. God hasn't promised him anything. For now, the situation is the same as it was two chapters ago. Job's family is still dead. His livestock are still gone. His house is still destroyed. His health is still failing. Job is still dying. What's different? Job is different. Why is he different? God hasn't promised him anything. God hasn't explained anything about what's happening. God came in a storm, but he hasn't explained the storm that took Job's health and family and livelihood away. What he has done is reminded Job that he's with him in the storm. That's it, Patrick. That's everything. What's been Job's refrain for 30 odd chapters? God, where are you? I can't see you. I need to hear from you. God, I've got to talk to you. God, I don't understand. But even when Job said, I don't understand, what was that code for? It was code for, God, I want you to come explain it to me. God, be here with me. Bring me to be with you. Talk to me. And here in these last two chapters, God is. And as he has, what has God reminded Job of? He's reminded Job, the fact that you don't understand doesn't mean that I'm not here. The fact that you don't understand the universe doesn't mean I didn't create it. The fact that you don't understand most of what happens in the world around you doesn't mean that my hand isn't on it. Our issue isn't that we don't understand the world. You and I aren't that different from Job. We stomp our feet. We pound our fist. We shout at the night sky, I don't understand. But our issue isn't that we don't understand the world. Turns, they lay eggs, and before the eggs hatch, they migrate. And once the eggs hatch, the little baby turns, they migrate, and they find their parents. How do they know where to go? Things that don't keep me up late at night. My point is there's a lot around us that we don't understand, more that we don't understand than we do understand. Not understanding isn't our problem. Our issue, like Job, is not that we don't understand God. We desperately want to believe that God understands us. We want to know it. We want to be able to hold it and hang on to it and trust it. It's not, God, I don't understand you. It's, God, I need to know you understand me. What changed for Job? God showed up. He was always there, but he spoke into Job's life. He revealed himself. And the reason Job is different at the beginning of chapter 40 is he no longer feels alone. He no longer feels abandoned. God is there, and even if God hasn't explained the first thing about the first thing, on some level, Job knows it's going to be okay. I don't know how, but God is here and it's going to be okay. How many times have you seen that on a smaller scale? Father and son, mother, daughter, between spouses. Your child comes to you with a broken toy or a broken arm or a broken heart and says, I fixed this. It hurts, fix it. And maybe you didn't have the answer. Maybe there was no answer. Maybe it was beyond repair. But on some level, through the tears and after the initial pain, it was enough, right? It was enough that you were there and you didn't know how to fix it together. That child, that friend, that spouse didn't have to be alone in the not knowing. Same with God. even though he has all the answers, because that's what it is to be God, it's not the answers that we really want. It's his presence that we need. God hasn't given Job answer one. But just by showing up, he's reminded Job that he is the answer. He's God over creation. God Most High, God over heaven and earth. God who's reminded Job, who does all things well. God who sees and God who knows. And none of that is remotely as important to Job as the fact that he's God who cares. God who loves. God who shows up. Thing about being a pastor is you get to be with people in the best moments of their life and the worst moments of their life. This week, I've gotten to sit with people who are planning their wedding. I've gotten to rejoice with people who got an unexpected promotion, which translates into provision that they were praying for. Got to talk on the phone with somebody who's embarking on a brand new season of ministry. And I've also talk to people who are saying, why am I a guy attracted to guys? Why do I still struggle with this addiction? Why, as soon as I get on top of one health issue, do I have another health issue? It's like playing whack-a-mole. Why don't I have friends? Why don't I have direction in my life? I spend a lot of time listening to questions that I don't have the answer to, not fully. And I've finally gotten okay with that. I've gotten okay saying, I don't know. I'm a guy, I like to fix things. I like to help people. The thing though, when someone says, why am I still struggling with this addiction? I've got half an answer to that question. But that answer is going to bring another question. And the answer to that is going to bring another question. And the answer to that is going to bring another question. I've got answers, but I know they're not going to satisfy. What people really need to hear, what I need to hear when it's my turn to ask the questions, is what Job needed to hear. We need to hear that God's not far away. He's not asleep. He's not on a break. He's not mad. He's not mean. He's with us and caring for us and loving us, even when he's not making sense to us. What about you tonight? What don't you understand? Whatever it is, are you willing to trade your question for the answer? Are you willing to put that question, that burden, that not knowing on the altar and saying, God, you might give me understanding. I might not ever comprehend why this is happening. But are you willing to entertain the possibility that God Himself is the answer, is the piece that's missing, is the thing you're wanting? Chapter 38, verse 7. As God breathed the universe into existence, the angels rejoiced. That's our default condition as believers, or it should be. Our baseline status should be peace that surpasses understanding, joy unexplainable. Are you willing this evening to entertain the possibility that you could have those things without understanding. That you could have peace in the middle of the storm. That you could have joy even while you're in pain. Even if that were possible, Patrick, how would that even come about? How did it come about for Job? It came about as he stopped speaking, as he stopped arguing, as he stopped explaining, as he stopped demanding, as he simply listened. God is a father. God is a husband. God is a creator. God is a healer. God is a teacher. God is willing to instruct. He may not teach the lesson that we want. He may not give us the curriculum or the class that we signed up for. But if we're willing to listen, he's willing to teach. If we're willing to be still and know that he's God, he's willing to be present. God was with Job the whole time. God is everywhere all the time. Why did Job not perceive him sooner? I think it's because he wasn't ready to listen. And he wasn't willing to have a conversation on God's terms. He wasn't willing to be still and let God say, here's what you need to understand. It's not about understanding. It's about trusting. That just like I manage so many other things that you do not and cannot and will not ever understand, I'm in the middle of this situation right now. I'm with you in the middle of this situation right now. And I will not leave you alone. Lord, we come before you tonight. Every one of us with our own struggle. Some are very specific and easily defined. Some are vast and amorphous and hard to explain. But Lord, through it all, you are unchanging. You're steadfast and immovable. You are love. Sometimes we go away. Sometimes we fill all the bandwidth with our complaint, our lament. Lord, we're going to give you this time. We're going to listen. And we're going to ask that even when this time is over, that you would remind us to listen, to sit at your feet, to be reminded of who you are, to be renewed, to have our hope restored. Lord, right now we don't ask for understanding. We ask for your presence. Be with us now. Speak to our hearts.